From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the city of Detroit and House Speaker Jace Bolger.
There are people, including representatives, some of them from Detroit, who said that Jace Bolger has never seen an anti-Detroit policy that he didn't like.
But has that changed since the speaker's visit to Detroit?
They went into broken neighborhoods, went into abandoned houses, walked up and down and saw the scrap metal fest.
Plus, what does the future hold for retirement?
The unspoken, I guess, contract that companies have with their employees no longer really exists.
And we look at bullying through the eyes of the bully.
I didn't want to be messed with. I didn't want you looking at me a certain way. I didn't want you picking on me. And I would nip it right away.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Wednesday. On the show today, we'll talk about a subject many young people do not think about enough: retirement. When should you start saving and how much? Then a surprising new study finds binge drinking is up among high school students. And that's not all. It's a rising problem across the Midwest. Then later in the hour, a very personal story from a filmmaker who overcame being a bully as a child and how her mission today is to educate kids and parents and how that resulted in a powerful new film. But first, as Detroit's troubles and dirty laundry are aired out on a worldwide stage, there's been plenty of finger-pointing and judging of the city's leaders, employees, retirees, and citizens. But a new analysis from Michigan State University suggests we might want to hold off on judging Detroit and take a look at other Michigan cities and towns. That MSU report finds communities all around Michigan face the very same mountain of legacy debt that toppled Detroit. Eric Scorsone is an economist with Michigan State University and is the study's co-author. And Eric, one of the fundamental truths of what we're about to discuss is the fact you cannot hang Detroit's problems on Kwame Kilpatrick or Coleman Young or other individual leaders. Really, so much of this is about unfunded pension and retiree health care debt, right?
Right. It's definitely a system problem that, you know, certainly many, many people have been involved in on both labor and management. So it can't really point to any one person per se.
So give us a sense and an understanding of how these costs have tanked Detroit's finances.
Sure. Well, in the case of Detroit, you know, these have been built up over many decades. Promises were made to people that when they retired, they would receive certain income and health care coverage. And if you think about it, you know, police and fire, you know, fighters and so forth often retire before they're eligible for Medicare. And so these built up into essentially being hundreds of millions of dollars every year being paid out. And so as Detroit's economy shrunk, its tax base shrunk, you know, these promises, which may have seemed affordable 30, 40 years ago, were not affordable anymore. And so essentially it's really what drove Detroit towards bankruptcy more than, you know, even traditional debt kinds of payments. And so that's kind of where Detroit is. And that's why so much discussion on this bankruptcy goes around, you know, retirees and what they're receiving and what's fair and so forth.
And so as the city goes more and more into the red, you start laying off workers, cutting back services, trying to raise taxes. And then people say, well, who wants to live here? We're moving. And then you have the add in the collapse in housing prices, and then you mix in a big cut in state municipal funding. So it really is a recipe for disaster. And your analysis finds that this scenario could be looming for many cities around Michigan?
Right. I mean, we looked at this is primarily a benefit that's been offered by mostly cities and villages, some counties, and then a few townships. And basically, yeah, we've actually, the total number of unfunded liabilities, and this is over a 30-year period, would be somewhere in $12 to $13 billion. And so that's a really enormous number. And you see small communities, mid-sized communities that owe lots of money relative to the size of their budget. And it's doing the same kinds of things as, you know, in the case of Detroit, they're having to either cut services or raise taxes, cut benefits, and really being forced to make very difficult choices, especially as the economy has continued to struggle.
And in all of this, we've certainly heard from it very vociferously in Detroit and in these, and I'm sure we will in other cities as well. The pensioners are the ones that did their bit. They put out the fires and they carried the trash and made the water run and then retired. So it is just it's not their fault, if you will, is it, in any way?
Right. I don't think it's, at this point, you know, saying who's to blame, I mean, it probably goes everywhere. And I think the issue we have to address as a state, as local communities, and really as a, even as a country, is how do we compromise and figure out how to fix these problems? Because we made promises, and some of them may be unsustainable now.
Well, give us an idea, Eric Scorsone, of some of the cities in Michigan carrying the largest legacy costs.
Certainly there's the ones you might expect, Pontiac, Detroit, Flint, Saginaw, places where there was often a large manufacturing base. But you also see smaller communities, Essexville, for example, Kalkaska Village, which owes, I think it was in the range of $6 million in unfunded liability. It's only a $1 million budget. There are places in the Upper Peninsula, like Crystal Falls. There are places on the west side, such as, you know, Kalamazoo, and many Detroit suburbs. So it really varies across the state, both urban and rural. And so this is definitely not just sort of a Detroit problem.
And cities that would be considered even middle to upper class. I see Ann Arbor and Westland, for instance, on this list of largest legacy cost burdens in Michigan.
Yeah, I think that's why this Detroit discussion needs to be much broader. It has to be about, we all face these kinds of challenges. The state of Michigan itself faces these very same kinds of challenges with its retiree health care liability, I think, is in the billions by itself. So, I mean, it's a discussion we have to have, and it echoes the discussions we're having in the federal government around how to deal with our debt at that level. You know, it's really some of the same kinds of challenges. And I think we have to find ways, hopefully we can find some solutions that will help those folks in Washington understand that there are ways to figure these problems out.
I'm speaking with Eric Scorsone of Michigan State University, who co-authored a report finding that cities all over Michigan face the very same mountain of legacy debt that pulled Detroit into bankruptcy. And as we talk about this, you say, starting a conversation, Eric, with ideas. So what could be done to fix things before a city tips over the cliff the way Detroit does?
There's really a couple different things. One, you have to look at the benefit and what's being provided. Are there other ways to provide the benefits that are more least expensive and that really still provide some of the same level of coverage? There may be, it may require raising taxes. Some communities, especially maybe wealthier communities, may find that that's the solution. You know, they have the resources. You know, some communities, they've had to, you know, reduce services, and maybe some of those services weren't as needed. My guess is it's going to often be a combination of those things, and it's going to certainly vary by community. There's really no one solution. There may be a role for the state to play, and there's been some discussion of the state kind of helping out here, as other states do in other parts of the country. So we have to have that discussion, though. I think bottom line, we're trying to raise awareness so that that discussion can be based on the facts and based on, you know, working through our governance system.
There do seem to be accusatory fingers pointed at the city employee unions. Is there some blame to be ladled out at the folks who handled the pensions and ran the unions?
Well, I think, you know, at this point, blame is tough to say. I mean, I think obviously these agreements are made by both labor and management, so they both played a role in the process. At the same time, you know, in the 1960s, 70s, even maybe 1980s, these things may have seemed very affordable because we had a very large auto industry. We had a lot more wealth. And so, you know, you can't really blame people for saying, well, at that time they couldn't have imagined what was going to happen, especially if you're in a place like, say, Detroit or Flint.
Sure.
And so, you know, I think it's fair to say the state played a role because it set some of the policies that guided the process. And we didn't even account for this. This wasn't even on the balance sheet. So from an accounting perspective, leaders weren't even aware of what these costs were going to be. It was only until like 3 or 4 years ago this was even on the balance sheet of local governments. And so, you know, for a lot of reasons, this is why we're here today.
Yeah, and I say that statement as the daughter of a Ferndale fire captain who served the city of Ferndale from before World War II until 1983. So it's very much something that is impacting homes like the one I grew up in. And I'm wondering, what should city employees, state leaders, and city officials take away from the study you've done and the analysis you've done?
Well, I think there's two key things. One, we've got to work towards compromise and finding solutions that, you know, where everyone's going to share in maybe the sacrifice and find ways that these promises that were made, we can make them affordable and still, you know, meet our commitments to future generations. Because really it's going to be future generations that are going to be hit hard if we don't find solutions now. And the longer we wait, the worse it gets. And point two, we don't want this to happen again. So even while we're fixing the problem, you know, we need to make sure we don't make myopic decisions going forward. So we need to find ways to, as leaders, whether it's policy changes, so that when we make promises, we fund those promises, or we make sure we don't make promises that are unaffordable. And we make assumptions about the future where we're, you know, we should be conservative, you know, thinking that, you know, things may be different. So these are challenges because they affect, you know, the very way we think as human beings. But I think we want to make sure we don't get into this kind of problem in the future.
Eric Scorsone with Michigan State University, also a former chief economist for the State Senate Fiscal Agency. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Eric. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As social media has embedded itself into our lives, so too has the national conversation about bullying. Facebook, Twitter, and other forms of social media have given bullies boundless opportunities to torture their victims. What used to be something that happened in school halls or cafeterias and classrooms now find its way into every corner of the lives of young people. One of the voices that has joined this conversation about bullying is that of a Michigan filmmaker. Her newest film, a docudrama shot in Oakland County, is called The Bully Chronicles, bringing us the story of teen bullying through the eyes of the bully.
I guess people are talking about me being a mean person, thinking that I'm a bitch. And I don't know what makes them say that.
That's the voice of Avery Keller, a popular high school sophomore whose physical, emotional, and cyberbullying results in the suicide attempt of her former best friend. Filmmaker Amy Weber joins us now to talk about her film, The Bully Chronicles, and her message to kids and parents. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So you are a filmmaker. You are a mom of two girls, but you bring a really unique perspective to this conversation because you were a bully. How bad a bully were you, and when did this happen?
Well, it was in grade school. When I was six, I think I have to back up a little bit because mm-hmm. of what, inspired that behavior in mm-hmm. myself. When I was 6 years old, we lived in Saginaw, and I had a friend named Billy. I still think of him mm-hmm. quite often these days. And Billy and I were very close friends in school. And when I started going over to his house, he lived around the block from me. Mm-hmm. When I started going to his house after school, things drastically changed. And Billy started to abuse me in many, many ways, both physically, mentally. If I didn't do what he wanted me to do, he would lock me into a closet or in his trundle bed. He would threaten me constantly. And as a six-year-old, of course, I had never been exposed to this type of behavior before or treatment. And even as a six-year-old, I wasn't one to go out and project this out to people in the world of what was happening. I kept it very close.
You locked it up.
I did. And
you kept going over.
And I did. And I did. And it eventually escalated into a one-day event where I could no longer hide. I did mention to his mom some of the behavior that was going on, and she said, oh, not my Billy. Billy would never do mm-hmm. such a thing. But to tell my own parents was very difficult for me for some reason. I was embarrassed. I didn't want them to think that I would allow someone to pick on me like that. So one afternoon, my mom was coming home from the store. She drove around the block, stopped by. We were outside in front of his house. She asked if I wanted to come home. And I wanted to say so badly yes. He stood behind me. He said, say no, say no. So I said, no. She drove away and he grabbed the back of my head and he said, you're so lucky you said no. And he threw me down face first into the cement, which damaged my four front teeth so badly that when my adult teeth grew in, they grew in a very dark gray. Obviously, I could no longer hide what was going on and had to disclose to my parents exactly what was happening. And from that day, I was safe from him. When we moved when I was age 7, things changed for me. And I decided new city, new school, things were going to be a little different.
A new you. And how are they going to be different?
I wasn't going to let anybody push me around. So first day of school, I kind of built this reputation for myself. I was fairly tough. I hung around all boys. I was very athletic. So I was used to the rough and tough. And I guess it was just this energy about me that I put out to the world that I didn't want to be messed with. I didn't want you looking at me a certain way. I didn't want you picking on me. And I would nip it right away as soon as it would happen. A boy would tease me or get physical with me, and I would fight him, and I would beat him up.
All right.
And I wasn't allowed to fight. My mother was very much against me fighting. In fact, I would get into trouble. But I would always say, he started it. You know, isn't that what we always say as young people? He started it. But I started to realize around the third grade that this reputation wasn't really serving me. My friends weren't really my friends. They were people who stood by me so I didn't pick on them.
That's a pretty deep insight for a third grader.
I noticed things. I was an observer, and I talked about a lot of things except for myself. I never really talked about Amy. I talked about everybody else. And I wasn't a mean-spirited person. I was not what you would define today as a mean girl.
Okay.
I was a very lost young person who was destructive. I was violent, I was destructive, and I projected a lot of pain that I had, not just from the incident that I went through that I never really got to talk about, but also because I wasn't always heard in my home, and I felt sometimes that my voice didn't matter, and I think that's why I was so aggressive, because that was the only way I really knew how to communicate how I was feeling without literally saying how I was feeling.
And when did you move beyond punching people out and being aggressive and into a more constructive way of making friends and being around people?
Middle school was when I decided to change my ways. Now, I have to kind of give a lot of credit to my mother, who always stood by me and loved me through all of those aggressive years when she was constantly coming to the principal's office, taking me home because he would say, we can't have this behavior in school. And she never made me feel like I was a bad person. You know, I get kind of emotional about that because my mom was just somebody who unconditionally loved me. And she was that person that I always felt safe that I could come and talk to. And even though I wasn't able to express what I was going through during that time, I always knew she was there and she would always love me.
So you got off that track.
I did.
And you've kind of taken what happened to you and what you did in school, and you've turned it into quite a campaign, your movie The Bully Chronicles, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to talk first about a recent article you wrote for the Huffington Post. It's a letter to the teens accused of bullying that 12-year-old Florida girl to the point where she committed suicide by jumping off a tower. And your post was headlined, From One Bully to Another, An Open Letter to Rebecca Sedgwick's Bullies. And in it, you say, you are not bad people. The fact that one of those two girls who were charged posted an incriminating statement on Facebook that clearly enraged the sheriff in Florida, and he arrested the 12 and 14-year-olds. They've pleaded not guilty to felony charges of aggravated stalking. But the world was appalled, and I think a lot of people would feel with this instance or that of Phoebe Prince, the Irish student in Massachusetts who committed suicide, you know what? Throw the book at them as a deterrent to others. So you can understand why people look at that and they are appalled.
I completely understand that. I call that an inflammatory reaction. And it is a reaction. And we always want to protect the weak. We want to go into that schoolyard. And our personal experiences absolutely come into play when it comes to these reactions. what we might have felt. And we want to walk into that schoolyard and protect that young person who is being bullied, picked on, whatever term you want to use. And we want to give it to the bully. We want to stick it to him, an eye for an eye. This is our society, and this is how we're really raised to believe that we have this perception that people who harm other people are bad people. Mm. They were born bad people. They have no empathy at all. They have no ability to feel empathy at all. And that the only way we can really deal with these people is we need to get rid of them.
So what are you saying to these two bullies in your letter?
Well, to Caitlin and Guadalupe, who are the the young ladies, absolutely 100% had some part. Their behavior led to the demise of her spirit. And what I said to them and what I wanted them to know, and all people who identify with this behavior, is that they are not bad people. They are making very bad choices. They need to stop and take a look at the choices that they're making. And for these young ladies, I wanted them to know that there is a hand reaching down there, offering them help to help pull them out of that hole. And it begins is literally you have to build this ladder to get yourself out. You cannot just be pulled out of it. To understand that you're living up to this reputation and everyone's kind of expecting you to be this negative person who behaves this way. And, oh, isn't this all funny? And we're just playing around and we're being funny. And there's really no understanding of the consequences of what's coming out of your mouth, what you're typing online. Absolute disconnect. There's an unconsciousness that's so deep that it's literally down in that hole with you. So what I wanted them to know is to begin building the ladder to get themselves out. It begins with talking. It begins with sharing your story of how you feel. And even though we don't create a safe space for young people to come forward and talk about, I do think I identify as this person. It's embarrassing. It's just as embarrassing for the bully it is for the victim. Sure, they boast about it, and sure, they'll brag about it to certain people, but put them in the public eye or put them in a forum that they know they're not welcome.
Shine a light on them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they cower. And why do they do this? Because deep down, this is not who they really are. This isn't what they really stand for. This is an actual defense coping mechanism in dealing with the pain that they don't even understand, and a projection of that pain onto someone else that, yes, it does make them feel better. Yes, for that one moment when they're brutalizing another person, there is a relief that the focus isn't on me. I don't have to think about me. I don't have to think about what my life is.
Right, right.
I can make you think about what your life is, and I can put everybody else's eyes on you too, so those eyes are off of me.
You actually show this in action, in a sense, in your movie, The Bully Chronicles, which you shot in Southeast Michigan. Give us a sense of what is in the movie and the plot of the movie.
Sure. After the attempted suicide of a 16-year-old girl named Jessica Burns results in a coma, a documentary film crew go into the school to investigate what had happened to her. And it's through that investigation that they meet another 16-year-old named Avery Keller, who they are quick to learn was her tormentor, her bully. And it is through this investigation that we are offered this unprecedented look into the life of a bully.
And what it's like through her eyes.
And what it's like through her eyes. And we get to learn about Avery firsthand through video journals that she does for the film crew, welcoming us into her family, getting to know that dynamic, and learning from her and watching as her world changes as a result of her actions over the past 6 months of her life.
What do you hope this adds to the national conversation about bullying? Because it's everywhere. We've got the headlines of the trouble in the Miami Dolphins camp, where you had Jonathan Martin walking away from his team because of what he claims is bullying behavior. So it's beyond teenage mean girl things. It really is part of our life.
It is, unfortunately. And I think that a lot of people who are in touch and in tune these days would say that it's absolutely getting worse. And we have to do something outside of our comfort zone in order to finally bring an end to this crisis. We have to bring it full circle into the light and shine the brightest light on it and expose all truth surrounding it. And that is the hope that the Bully Chronicles offers, if you will, a spark to ignite a conversation that humanizes the issue on all sides, the bully side, the victim side, the parent side, the school side, administrative side, on every angle of this, but especially getting to the heart of these so-called monsters, getting into their minds, their hearts, finding out what's going on with them and what these underlying issues are that are creating so much havoc that they project so much pain onto other people.
Oakland County filmmaker Amy Weber, and you can learn more about her film at the website. It is TheBullyChronicles.com. Amy, thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
There has been much attention and much talk paid to binge drinking among college-age students. But what about high school students? That's what the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research wanted to find out about. As part of its annual Monitoring the Future study, researchers collected data from more than 16,000 high school seniors surveyed between the years 2005 and 2011. Developmental psychologist Megan Patrick was the lead author of this study. Megan, what did you find?
So this is the first study to document rates of having 10 or more and 15 or more drinks in a row, which we call extreme binge drinking, in a national sample of high school students. And so what we found was about 1 in 10 high school seniors has had 10 or more drinks in a row, and about 1 out of 20 high school seniors has had 15 or more drinks in a row in the past 2 weeks.
That is stunning. Were you surprised by that?
The rates were higher than we expected.
Yeah, that because when you're talking about something like 15 or more drinks in a row, that's not just worrying about a youngster, you know, being drunk or driving drunk. That could kill them.
Exactly. These levels of drinking can result in very high blood alcohol levels, which can lead to blackouts, alcohol poisoning, accidents.
What about in Michigan? Were there trends that you could talk to us about that you found in our state?
We did not look at states specifically, but we did look at rates by region of the country. So students in the Midwest had relatively high rates of extreme binge drinking compared to students in other regions of the country. We found that almost 13% of Midwestern 12th graders reported having 10 or more drinks in a row, and over 7% reported having 15 or more drinks in a row in the past 2 weeks.
Has anyone tried to kind of parse together why that is?
You know, we know that drinking overall is higher in the Midwest, and so that's also true for teenagers.
What about boys versus girls?
So boys engage in more extreme binge drinking behavior than girls, but it's also important to remember that the same level of alcohol use can be riskier for girls as they're smaller in size, mm-hmm. and also that women metabolize alcohol differently than men.
Were you able to piece anything together with respect to urban versus suburban versus rural?
Yeah, so kids in rural areas also engage in more extreme binge drinking than those in suburban and urban areas.
What do you hope will be done with the results of this study?
Well, we hope that the study will bring awareness to the issue and that it will promote efforts to reduce these behaviors among high school students in the U.S.
And what kinds of conversations do you think should be happening at home between parents and these high schoolers?
So parents definitely need to be talking to their kids. And there are some great resources from the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism and the National Institute on Drug Abuse about how to do that.
And you got kids who at that age feel pretty invincible, don't they?
They do, and we need to remind them that bad things can happen.
Megan Patrick was the lead author of this binge drinking study done by the U of M Institute for Social Research. Megan, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Late last month, October 28th to be precise, the Speaker of Michigan's House traveled from Lansing to Detroit, not for a political meeting, nor a dinner or a ball game. Midland Republican Jace Bolger came at the invitation of a Detroit lawmaker to see for himself just what people in Detroit are facing day in and day out. And it would seem that what he saw and what he heard left its mark. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley has written a series of pieces about this apparent enlightenment of House Speaker Jace Bolger, and she joins us now. Welcome back, Rochelle.
Thank you very much.
So set this up for us. Who exactly invited Speaker Bolger to come and see what life is like for Detroiters?
Representative Harvey Santana, who has had his own issues with Speaker Bolger, invited him. He said, you know what, you need to understand that when we come to you and ask for things, you've got to see why we're asking and what it's about. So come and look for yourself. And true enough, the speaker and the speaker pro tem came to Detroit, and they visited the west side, all up and down the west side, went into broken neighborhoods, went into abandoned houses, walked up and down and saw the scrap metal theft and the stripping of houses that are left, you know, just shells for, you know, criminals to use to hurt children. And went by to, you know, they stopped on the street, which is one of the most interesting things, and talked to people. And two things came out of this. One is I think Jace Bolger really had no idea what life was like in Detroit. And two, it, rather than be ambivalent about it, he seems to really sort of want to do something about it. There are skeptics, but he's on a mission.
And in fact, you describe that visit as a watershed moment for Speaker Bolger. What happened once he got back to Lansing?
He immediately started talking to colleagues about how they have to embrace Detroit. Now, of course, there's no coincidence that this interest in embracing Detroit comes as Detroit is about to undergo major change and is about to probably have its filing for bankruptcy accepted. And there's going to be a whole lot of different people in charge who Jace Bolger might, quite frankly, like better. But what he did immediately was help get the scrap metal legislation passed, which Representative Rashida Tlaib had been trying to get done for 3 years. And then he started talking about the high insurance costs, trying to figure out some way to amend the insurance bill. He started talking about whether criminals needed to go to jail and instead should be sentenced to help clean up Detroit if they're nonviolent offenders. All types of ideas started going through his head.
And ideas that we know there's not a lot of money in the piggy bank, but these are ideas that could be affected without having to break open that piggy bank.
The only one that would require some money has to do with public safety, where he talked about just the possibility. Now, mind you, he kept saying, I'm just noodling this, of doing in Detroit what they did in Flint, where they had Michigan State Police to go in and sort of do this zero tolerance breakdown, you know, crackdown to try and help make things better.
Yeah.
But the point was, every single thing that residents and community leaders brought up, he went back and talked about. And that's just not happened. That's one of those things where you go, okay, if this is real, this is good. This is, you know, the beginning of what could be the end of this horrible and decades long feud between Lansing and its largest city.
Now, the word if comes to mind. As you said, if this is real, this is good. And as you point out in your pieces, the speaker's visit happened actually on the very day Governor Snyder and Kevin Orr were, you know, testifying in the bankruptcy trial. And has that timing fueled suspicion by some that Jace Bolger wants to maybe put on a legislative Superman cape and look good?
Oh, absolutely. There are people, including representatives, some of them from Detroit, who said that Jace Bolger has never seen an anti-Detroit policy that he didn't like, and that they think this is all just for show, which, of course, time will tell. The great thing about facts and about whether people are doing things is we will see. You know, at some point we will know whether he actually is serious or whether this is bluster. But some people are not buying it. Some people are amused that he was surprised at the level of antipathy towards Lansing legislators by people in Detroit. He said, I had no idea that there was that much anger. And I'm like, okay, so you don't read newspapers. But I think the biggest thing and the most important thing is, if this is real, this is the way it should be. I've never lived in any state, and I've only lived in six different states, where there was such a segregationist view and a sort of a hate-filled relationship between the state capital and the city that literally is the engine for the state. You know, it's not, we're not talking, you know, no offense to any small town, but, you know, we're not talking Monroe and Lansing not paying attention to Monroe. We're talking Detroit, which for a lot of people around the world is Michigan.
And so, your column points out he seemed to kind of get that, didn't he? He made some comments about realizing that when people think Michigan, they do think Detroit.
If somebody had told me 4 years ago, maybe a year ago, that Jace Bolger would say, when I travel around, and not just in other states, but around the world, and people see Michigan through Detroit's eyes and we need to embrace Detroit, I literally would not have believed them. But he not only said it, but I think he means it, and he says that there needs to be a better Detroit for his kids. So people do get the sense that, you know, there's something happening, and all we can do is hope again that this is the beginning of a different kind of era for Detroit, a different kind of era for the state, and a new beginning for a relationship between the two.
And meantime, following this visit to Detroit and this kind of enlightenment, if we can call it that, we had Detroit Mayor-elect Mike Duggan at the Capitol yesterday meeting with legislative leaders like Jace Bolger and members of the governor's staff. Did we get any sense of how things went in this visit?
I think most likely what he wanted to do was tell them, get used to seeing me so that you know who I am. And he's getting ready to, well, he just announced his transition team, and so they'll have a sense of who they're going to work with when all of these temporary emergency folks are gone. I think that between the two candidates, what you always want is somebody who's going to work with what's happening to make it better, even if you're trying to change it, instead of immediately saying, well, none of this is going to work, we're going to go backwards. And so there's got to be some forward thinking, some forward progress going on. And I think he just wanted to tell them in person that that's what's happening.
And I have to say, I just as somebody who lives in Southeast Michigan, and as I read your pieces that you put together as Speaker Bolger visited Detroit and then the aftermath, it's nice to read something that is kind of a sense of thawing and kind of hopeful.
That's my goal for 2014. I'm going to be spending a lot more time in Lansing. I can hear the screams coming from the legislators now. what I want to do is to stay on forward. That is literally, you know, my gear is going to be in drive forward all the time. And what I want to do is make sure that anybody who claims they're going to do something to help Detroit, I mark it on the calendar so I can go back and say, okay, this is what you said you do. Anybody who wants the state to be better and wants every city to be better and wants the lives of children to be better, I'm on your side. Anybody who's lying, either to get elected or to get some money or to make a point, I'm on your back. So we're going to just keep up with what's going on. I made a point of saying, as we do the Jace Bolger tour, we're going to keep on it. I plan to write about every step of the way how he keeps his promise to those people that he met and those people that he saw, and the mom taking cupcakes to her kid at school across the street from all these abandoned buildings that are so dangerous. He was affected, and if he really is on a mission, I plan to document the mission.
And we plan to be talking to you about it.
Absolutely. Always glad to.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Thanks for your time, Rochelle.
Thank you.
It used to be a worker could set his or her sights on retiring at, age 65, get the gold watch, and join the ranks of the retired. This is no longer true. From longer life expectancy to the baby boomers whose investments and house values were tanked by the Great Recession, to younger workers being squeezed out by older workers hanging onto their jobs longer, retirement in America has certainly changed. The American Retirement Initiative came about to help lead the conversation about how to improve retirement planning for all of us. It's headed up by a Michigander who got his undergrad economics and graduate business degrees from the University of Michigan. Keith Green is the president at the American Retirement Initiative. Keith, let's go back, say, to 1963. Tell us, how has retirement changed in these 50 years?
Retirement's changed pretty dramatically. At that time, the majority of retirement plans were the defined benefit plans, where you get a certain amount a month when you retire based on how long you worked and your age and a formula that it was calculated. Since that time, the future of those types of plans has really been in doubt. There was a study this year that pointed out that the number defined benefit plans has hit, they called it an all-time low. Of course, it's not an all-time low, but it's the lowest it's been in a generation or two. Since 1995, the number of defined benefit plans has continued to decrease. And that puts a real and different type of burden on folks. I'm asked a lot to talk about the future of retirement and the future of retirement plans. And my answer is always, it depends on how old you are.
Sure.
If you're near retirement and you've had a defined benefit plan that you've had for a long time, then your situation is going to be very different than if you're a person just entering the workforce and different things are required of you than were required of your parents or grandparents as it relates to retirement.
And then the Great Recession hits us. So there's a lot of people who couldn't even afford to think of retiring now, could they?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. First of all, we weren't doing such a great job of saving anyway. Employee Benefit Research Institute, EBRI, has this study every year called the Retirement Confidence Survey. And what it does is it measures the views of the American public, just as it relates to retirement. And they released their, I think this year was their 23rd survey. They ask about 1,000 folks, and of that 1,000, about a quarter or so are retirees. And it asked them, do they feel that they'll be able to retire? And over half the folks, 45 and older, and about almost 60% in general, say that they have less than $25,000 in savings and investments. And you know, and think about that. When you're over 45 and half are not confident about being able to afford a comfortable retirement, which is the highest level right now in the survey's history. Hmm. So it was bad before the Great Recession started. It became significantly worse afterwards. So there are some real problems there.
You know, Keith, you pointed out how companies have shifted away from the defined benefit retirement plans, and now it's the 401k retirement and savings plan where you kick in some and your companies may match or may not. And a lot of people aren't kicking in because they're making it from paycheck to paycheck. So as a result, companies don't have to match. But now we're also seeing another change in the sense of companies being more cautious about employing full-time workers. They're stocking their ranks with the part-time workers who don't enjoy full benefits. You've got millennials. These younger workers are kind of squeezed out of jobs because the older workers have to hang on longer. So they're stitching together a patchwork of part-time jobs. So what does retirement planning look like for these folks?
Retirement planning is a lot more challenging. When you look at Michigan and you ask, how is Michigan different from the economy as a whole? There are a few differences. One, obviously, is there's larger union representation in Michigan. About, 10% or so of Americans are represented by unions. And in 2013 in Michigan, it was a little over 17%. So that's significantly higher. Because of when you look at the Michigan's largest employers, the overwhelming majority of them have defined benefit type of retirement plans. Many of those are collectively bargained, you know, particularly the autos. So in terms of benefits, and I know this very well, My dad worked for GM for almost 40 years. One thing that we haven't talked about is retiree health care.
Yes.
And retiree health care is going to continue to become an enormous issue. But my dad became very sick earlier this year, and the level of benefits that he had to cover all his various illnesses are very, very different than the benefits that I have, I mean, that are for folks in my age group, and are certainly going to be a lot richer than those that my children will have.
So we have to realize that this is the reality of America in 2013. So Keith Green, what would you say are the most important things that we should be doing, no matter what age we are, to plan for our retirement?
Two things: pay down debt and save more. Understand that the role that companies have traditionally had, the sort of the unspoken, I guess, contract that companies had with employers, with their employees, no longer really exists. Employees are a lot more mobile, so you're not going to stay at the same place for 25 or 30 years. Some people will, but relatively few people will when compared to the last 50, 60 years or so. So paying down debt to give yourself a clean start. Paying down debt does a couple things, too. It improves your credit rating. You're able to borrow for less money or lower interest rates, which means you have more discretionary income, which means you can save more. So paying down debt and saving more.
Okay.
And increasing the amount that you save as a percentage of income over time.
So if you get a raise or you move yourself into a job that pays more, then increase that chunk that you're setting aside. Don't fall into the temptation
of
buying stuff.
That's right. Exactly. And that's a tough thing to do. What is it? 70% or so of our economy is based on spending. So we're caught in a trap. You want to help the economy out. A certain amount of spending is necessary for all of us to be employed and to stay employed. So we have to spend. But on the other hand, you've got to think about your family, your future, and you have to save first.
And I think also realizing that that day of reckoning and that eventual retirement date rolls up a lot faster than you think it's going to when you're in your 20s and 30s.
A lot faster than you think it's going to. And you don't always have a choice as to when you're going to retire. You may plan on working until you're 70 or 65, but that's not a situation that you're 100% in control of. All sorts of things happen. Companies restructure, they lay people off, people become sick and can't work as long as they'd like to. So your plan cannot be based on everything going exactly right.
Keith Green is the president of the American Retirement Initiative. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our show today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia, and our engineer is Bob Skahn. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.